From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Options. Increasingly, for the past several years, the broadcast industry has come under fire for a variety of things. Probably the only clear-cut statement that can be made about the industry is that it reflects a variety of interests, goals, and abilities of the people it employs. On today's Options, we will hear from three people connected with broadcasting. First, we feature an address by Dr. Clay Whitehead, the director of the Office of Telecommunications Policy. Dr. Whitehead will be followed by an interview with Charlotte Reed, the only female commissioner for the Federal Communications Commission. We will end the show with an address by a former FCC commissioner, Nicholas Johnson. Dr. Clay T. Whitehead was born some 35 years ago in Kansas. He received his undergraduate degree at MIT in electrical engineering. He later specialized in economics and management. It was in that field that he received his doctorate. In 1968, Dr. Whitehead became a member of President-elect Nixon's Special Task Force on Budget Policy. In mid-1970, a new office called the Office of Telecommunications Policy was established. Dr. Whitehead was appointed director, and that is the post he currently holds. From the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, Dr. Clay Whitehead.
I left California some 5 years ago, the tender age of 29, to go to Washington, quote, for 2 years, unquote. 35 years old now, as was mentioned, 5 years later. And really, I think, I hope, much the wiser. These have been fascinating times. They have been interesting times. And today I thought the most valuable thing I could do was review for you briefly what some of the things were that were going through our minds when we were making communications policy back there over the last 3 years. And perhaps, if I can, indulge a bit in some personal reflections on government and business and the press and relations among the three. In many ways, this has to be a time to rethink. It's a very sad time in Washington. It's a time when the cynic might say there's nothing else to do but think. But I think when we're going through a period of questioning about government and its ability to govern, and no matter how you feel about the short-run issues, you have to stop and think a bit. Where have we been? Where are we going? There have been two principal threads running through the relationships and the strategy of this administration in dealing with the media. One thread is reflected in some of the statements that the former vice president made, and that falls in the category, I think, of legitimate haranguing back and forth between the press and the elected officials of our country. Another aspect of that thread, though, is of much more concern. It's reflected in the memos that were circulated within the White House and from the White House to the re-election committee about strategy in dealing with the nation's press institutions. And I commend that for all of you to read, because it's an example of something, a kind of thinking that ranges from foolish to impractical to unwise to perhaps illegal. It's a kind of thinking about a relationship between government and the media that has no place in the White House. It has no place in the Congress of the United States. It has no place anywhere in the government. I think we should learn that fact. But there's been another thread that's been going through this administration's relationship with the media. Talking now about radio and television regulation and policy, not the illegal, not the behind-the-scenes attempts to muscle or to induce a short-term coverage of the news that's favorable to your point of view, But talking now about the legal controls, the laws, the regulations of the Federal Communications Commission that apply to our electronic news media. In rethinking those policies, I have to tell you honestly that I come out about the same way. My thinking a year ago, when the administration was riding so high on the crest of a great landslide election, my thinking now, when the confidence and the credibility of the administration is at an all-time low, my thinking about policy remains the same. And I'd like to tell you today why. But first of all, let me make sure that you understand what the role of the Office of Telecommunications Policy is. We are the executive branch agency with responsibilities for electronic communications. We provide the executive branch component of that system of debate and checks and balances between the Congress, the judicial arm of our government, and the executive branch. We have no direct authority over any radio or television station or over the telephone company. It's our role principally to look ahead, look at the changes in the technology, the changes in uses that people and industry are making of this technology, and ask how should our laws, how should our regulations change to permit us to deal with this explosion of technology in the future. There have been two major threads, again, running through the development of electronic technology in this country. One is the proliferation that is probably best characterized by the transistor radio. Cheap, almost endlessly useful, endlessly diverse applications for electronics, from computers to sending men to the moon to the transistor radio and so forth. The second thread is in many ways the opposite. It's an increasing trend toward monopoly control of our communications systems, monopoly control of our common carrier telephone and other common carrier systems, monopoly control in our television broadcasting system. Now, in Washington these days, I think it's well known that there is a very common clash between big business and big government. The public, the consumer, call him what you will, is too often caught in the middle. And that is true, perhaps true in spades, when it comes to electronic communications. And I think it's not trite or not an overstatement to say that nowhere is this conflict between big business and big government more significant for our longer-run future as a country than in the field of communications. We are well on our way to becoming an electronic society, communicating electronically, our media, our press functioning electronically. If we don't adapt our laws and our policies, we're going to have our communications amongst ourselves and between ourselves dominated by this clash between big government and big business. We indulge what is an incredible amount of monopoly power in three companies, the three television networks, over what we see and hear on our television sets. We then rely on special interest groups, enterprising politicians and so forth, to push all manner of laws and regulations on our television media, forcing them to do the good programming that as big bad monopolists they won't do by themselves. In effect, the First Amendment to our Constitution for the electronic media now reads, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the press, except for good causes. When it comes to the common carrier side of communications, there are tremendous possibilities. When the 34 Communications Act was written, we basically knew only telephone and telegraph. Today, we talk about high-speed data communications through radio telemetry, all kinds of specialized devices you can plug into your telephone line, send messages, send pictures, send what have you. tremendous opportunities for all manner of specialized communication services that perhaps only a few will want and need. But again, for any of these services to be offered, they have to be approved by a bureaucracy in Washington. And one company, AT&T, has a huge local and long-distance monopoly over much of this communications. Now, our theory of government and monopoly used to be quite clear. Government existed and regulated the monopoly to protect the consumer from the abuse that that monopoly might otherwise indulge in. But now, more than ever, the monopolies have become huge institutions upon which our society depends, and government is more and more protecting the monopoly from competition. The answer to a proliferation of new and specialized communication services in the common carrier field is not to outlaw the competitors. The answer to biased news on monopoly television companies is not more regulation by the government. It's not government judgment about what's biased and what's not biased. The answer is more news, more diversity, more points of view. The answer to a bland television schedule is more choice for the viewer, more meaningful choice, rather than forcing him to go to his government, to go to his politicians, to bring government power to bear so that the government, in effect, programs our television screens. And in this clash between big government and big business, sometimes I think we let our emotions get carried away with us. We lose sight of the underlying reality of what's going on and what's getting lost in that clash. Perhaps we can indulge ourselves by nationalizing the railroads. Perhaps our energy crisis has become so severe that we will have no choice but to nationalize our oil companies. But can we really live in a society where, in effect, through extensive governmental controls over companies that are allowed and indeed given a government sanction to be monopolists, are in effect nationalized? Can we have a nationalized phone system in this country and continue to have the kind of modern, flexible communications we want into the future? Can we have a nationalized television system and really have a free marketplace of ideas? Can we allow this underlying trend of government control over communications to continue and still be the nation that we set out to be some 200 years ago? I really don't think so. And I think that as the war over the short-term rhetoric about the press and the First Amendment continues, and as the price wars and the competition wars and the common carrier field go on, I hope we'll all view it from the perspective of a little bit longer time frame and ask if we can really allow the communications media and our opportunities for communications amongst each other to be so heavily controlled, so heavily constrained by the political process. Thank you very much.
The director of the Office of Telecommunications Policy, Dr. Clay Whitehead, speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. The body that plays watchdog to the broadcasting industry is the Federal Communications Commission. One of the members of the senior board is a woman named Charlotte Reed. Mrs. Reed was appointed on July 2, 1971. At the time, she was serving her fifth term as a representative in Congress from the 15th District of Illinois. Lila Peterson visited Commissioner Reed in her offices.
Commissioner Reed, one of the basic criteria the commission uses for ruling is whether or not something is in the public interest. What, in your opinion, is the public interest?
That certainly, I would say, covers quite a broad scope of public interest, and this is, frankly, one of the frustrations, I think, being a commissioner, because it is a nebulous area. And I think it's very difficult for anyone to actually define public interest. You have to use your own good judgment in, I think, in each case. And what would be the public interest perhaps in one area might not be the same in another. So it is a nebulous area.
Could you give me a specific example?
Well, for instance, in certain areas of the country, when stations are ascertaining the needs of communities, one community might have a completely different need or interest than, say, in Mississippi than one would in Illinois, in my home, for instance. So I think this is a broad scope and very difficult to define. But as commissioners, when we are presented with problems, we try to approach each problem with that in mind, and with, of course, public interest in mind as it pertains to that particular problem.
Well, do you consider equally with the commercial broadcasters' side of the coin, do you listen to the suggestions and opinions that the private citizen has about his community and the television in his area?
Do I, as a commissioner?
Yes.
Well, I hear from many people that I get a great deal of mail from people throughout the country about various programs, and of course, unfortunately, you hear of the complaints. You seldom hear of the programs people really enjoy. But in this aspect, I do certainly hear from people throughout the country. Of course, I advise, when I respond, advise people to write to their stations. I think that can be much more effective for the individual to make known the complaint to the station. Then, of course, if a formal complaint, if the person wants to file a formal complaint, then he or she certainly can file a formal complaint with our commission. But I have found that broadcasters really try to respond to the consumer. And I think more and more realize that they must respond to the public needs.
Well, do you think they, in terms of a special interest programming, for an example, when the religious programs are run all on Sunday mornings, like early in the morning, do you think that caters to the public interest? It is more or less a convenient thing for them?
Well, I suppose it does, yes. It certainly... We associate religion with Sunday morning, and there are many people, I'm sure, who are unable to attend church who would like to, and this program fills that need.
A few weeks ago, the commission held hearings on the cable television question.
Yes.
And more or less it was just listening to both sides of the argument, from what I gathered of it. What have you done now? What is the commission doing now?
We have not met as yet on cable television, but now, of course, we will meet as a commission to discuss the pros and cons and discuss all of the opinions that we heard during those days of hearings and oral arguments. And then we'll have to come to some decision as to cable, and what that will be, I really don't know right now.
You have no inkling now at all which
no.
way the commission will go?
No, I don't.
Were there any, there weren't any private citizens there at that those hearings either, were there?
At that particular hearing, there usually are public interest groups, but seems to me there was one public interest group one day. But I can't recall what it was. But usually, when we have hearings of that kind, public interest groups are represented. Incidentally, we've in this vein, I don't know if you're aware that the commission has adopted a policy of having a meeting once a month for any public interest group who is interested in appearing before the commission. Of course, they must make the plans ahead of time, but we have met with various groups now through the months, and I feel that this is a good way to get the feeling that you were talking about. This is one way, certainly, that we do have a rapport and with and discussion with groups of this kind.
And then from what the feedback you receive from them, do you take that into consideration when you're making
decisions? Yes. Mm-hmm. We had, for instance, we had National Organization of Women Now, had last week, I can't think of the actual name of it. It's a black group, Blacks for Soul Television. We've met with them twice. We met with the Latinos. So that we are trying to cover various groups, as many as want to meet with us.
What is the commission doing now about regulating children's programming, making it better, raising the mental level stimulus for children?
Well, we've done a great deal, really, since I've been on the commission. I've been on the commission for 2 years. And during this time, we started a few months after I came on the commission with panel discussions, hearings, oral arguments on children's television. And, of course, now we have to decide just what we can do with all of this information that we have. But I feel we all, we all realize that something should be done. And this is of particular interest to me. I think perhaps as a mother, having raised children at the very beginning of television, and now as a grandmother, seeing my young grandchildren being interested in television, and certainly having a concern for the programs, for them, in the programs that they're watching.
Have you taken any specific steps yourself to sort of push it along?
Well, yes, I've talked with people in our department about it, hoping that we can expedite these matters, because I feel it is necessary. And I'll say here, broadcasters have responded in this instance in that they have cut down on commercial programs in children's programming. They have now discontinued the host being a part of the commercial, and they have also eliminated drug commercials, any drug-oriented commercials on children's programming. So I think that the broadcasters are aware of the concern throughout the country and are responding. You know, it was interesting to me, too. I was in the Congress before I went on the commission for 9 years, and right before I left, had nothing to do with my going on to the FCC, but I used to send out questionnaires to my constituents, and one of the questions I asked was, how do you feel about children's programming, violence commercials and so forth, and listed several categories. And, I think it was 85% people responding, parents particularly, showed tremendous concern, and that they were disturbed about some of the programs that their children were watching. So this is of concern to me, and I hope that we can expedite this and will come forth with certain guidelines, regulations that will be helpful.
You head the Defense Communications System, or you're the head. Is that the proper title for?
Well, it's the Emergency Broadcasting System.
Right. What does that entail? Just what things are you doing now?
Well, when I went on the commission, the chairman asked me to be defense commissioner. Each commissioner has some field of supposed expertise. Frankly, I think this was the one that was open, and that's why I was given this spot. But I have really worked very hard in this field to try to revise some of the standards and simplify some of the material that has been going out. Actually, now to tell you exactly what I for what I am responsible. I am responsible to see that the president gets on the air to the public in times of national emergency. And I don't know if you remember, back in 1971, there was a test, and it was a fiasco. It showed that the system really was not reliable. So I have been working towards simplifying this system, making it a viable system, so that that we will not have such things happen again.
Well, what sort of changes are you
Well, making? This gets a bit technical, but revised the so-called checklist for the stations. So each station that is participating knows exactly what he is supposed to do. The announcer knows exactly what he is supposed to do in time of emergency. This is, it's an orange and black checklist, so it's very easy to see. And they have been working closely with OTP and with
which is
the Office of Telecommunications Policy,
mm-hmm.
and with WACA, which is White House Communications, with NIAC, which is the National Industrial Advisory Committee. All of these abbreviations become confusing. But we've been working very closely to work out these revised standards and rules, and I think we've come forth with simplified rules so that the system will be a viable system. We had one test which was not for the general public. This was in April, and there were some problems, but we're really very pleased with the outcome.
Do you know how much longer it will be before it becomes a viable system?
Well, I feel that it is right now. We're sending out these our final checklists and forms, and I really feel that it is now. And we have I've been really pleased with the voluntary participation of stations throughout the country.
Commissioner, what background did you have in broadcasting before you were appointed as a member of the commission?
Well, my background was really as an artist. I sang on one of the networks, and a long time ago, many years ago, so that I never felt that this qualified me to serve on the commission, although I felt it did give me an understanding of all the problems and intricacies in broadcasting. But I've felt that my 9 years of legislative service certainly gave me a much better background for commission service.
Did you have any trouble making any transition into broadcasting when you were appointed?
On the commission?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I would say it was an adjustment for me because, frankly, I liked my work in the House. I really enjoyed the very wonderful association I had with my constituents. I enjoyed the work on the House, my committee work. So I didn't leave because I didn't like my work, but when the president asks you to serve in a certain capacity, you certainly take that into consideration. And I felt that it's good to change also, and that the commission would be a challenge, and it is. But it is extremely technical, and so that when I, really, the first few months, I felt as though I were in a brand new world, listening to a brand new language. And it just takes time to acclimate yourself to that kind of an atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I was told by a man who had served on the commission for years. I met him at a social function right after I went on the commission, and he said, it's going to take you at least 2 years before you really have a grasp of what you're doing. And I think that's true. But I've been on 2 years now, so I hope I have somewhat of a grasp, and I feel that I do. I enjoy it.
There are approximately 9,000 women who are employed in broadcasting in the industry now. Mm-hmm. And of those 9,000, out of 40,000 employed people, about 75% hold clerical positions. What are you doing to increase the amount of women, bring in more women into all levels of broadcasting?
Well, frankly, I suppose I haven't really been zeroing in on this particular aspect, although as a woman I certainly am more aware of the women's problems in this particular field or in any field. But maybe I've just more or less backed away from something like that. I think I did in the Congress, and I really don't want to do this, I feel that I'm on the commission to serve as a commissioner and not just as a woman. When I served in the House, I felt that I should serve my constituents as a legislator and not be just interested in the women's aspect.
Well, you are in a position that could have a certain amount of say, you know, power in that area.
Yes.
And I wondered, you know, if you had done anything.
I would say that whenever a woman is considered, for instance, for a position at the commission type position, I'm certainly very anxious, if she's qualified, that she be given every consideration. When I've talked with broadcasters throughout the country, I've discussed this aspect and would hope that they would pay more attention to the qualifications of women. And if in this way I'm helping the cause, why, I would say that I've certainly been doing that.
Well, Commissioner Hooks is quite vocal about blacks in
yes,
the broadcasting industry, and also he has come out and said that broadcasters must hire more women, you know, or the FCC will begin putting, pushing them more into that area, too.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, since you are the logical person,
yes.
I wonder why it took a black male, the only black man on the committee, rather than you?
Well, I think perhaps, as I said, just because I had this feeling, and maybe from my work in the House, that I did not want to serve women's interests. I felt that I must have a broader scope than that, and perhaps I've bent over a little backwards too much in that respect. I don't know, but certainly I have not been unaware of these problems and have tried to help when I can, but I haven't gone all out, I'll say that.
Do you feel that when you were appointed in 1971 by the president and now as a member of the commission that it was to fill the token female role?
Well, I hope not, because I didn't feel that way. I felt that the president did feel that I was qualified for the position as a commissioner, and certainly not just as a woman.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was FCC Commissioner Charlotte Reed talking with Lila Peterson. At one time, one of Charlotte Reed's fellow commissioners was a man named Nicholas Johnson. Johnson, a native of Iowa City, attended the University of Texas, where he earned his BA and LLB degrees. He served as law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, and later joined the University of California Law School faculty. In 1964, he was appointed Federal Maritime Administrator, and 2 years later appointed Commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. Johnson has been known as a long-standing broadcast critic, and recently he spoke at the University of Northern Iowa.
I was appointed to a 7-year term on the FCC by President Johnson in 1966, and that term was supposed to run out in June 30th of this year. But under the law, as he mentioned, I continue to serve until my successor is finally sworn in. Now, I suppose in an administration that can't fill 200 of its 400 most important posts, an administration that is doing without a vice president, an administration that is trying to conduct trade negotiations with the USSR at a time when we don't have an ambassador in Russia, I suppose that one can't really complain too much or feel much alarm at the fact that we failed to appoint a new FCC commissioner. And in fact, I think we ought to have some sympathy for President Nixon's position. He had a lot of unfilled vacancies all along, and what's now happening is simply that his old appointees are being indicted faster than he can find replacements. But I rather expected that he was going to act before now, in my case anyway. There have been repeated attacks on me by Republican spokesmen over the 7 years, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Vice President Agnew, and others who the president trots out from time to time to do his bidding. And there were 5 state associations of broadcasters that tried to have me impeached on one occasion. I'm proud to say that the Iowa broadcasters were not among them. But the charges, as best I could gather them, was that I was too vigorously enforcing the public interest. And when I made it clear that I would be delighted to take on that impeachment trial, the interest in it kind of waned and faded. But in any event, I rather suspected that I would be replaced by a knock on the door in the early morning hours of July 1 and dragged from my post and replaced by some successor. Sort of like Clark Kerr, who was president of the University of California. He got into a little trouble with the governor there. They had some different feelings about the importance of education in the 20th century. Governor Reagan not having much in the way of views of any kind whatsoever about the 20th century. And finally, Clark Kerr kind of faced up to the reality that he confronted and said, he had a very short speech when he left. He said simply, I leave as I came, fired with enthusiasm. I had been saving that little speech myself, and I thought I would use it in July, but I've never had a chance yet. And to tell you the truth, I'm really a little disappointed. It took the president 2.5 months to come up with any name at all. And so far, the Senate Commerce Committee, which has something of a consumer orientation to it, has refused even to hold hearings on Mr. Quello. You know, it wasn't exactly like I just gave him 2 weeks' notice. I mean, they really had 7 years to prepare for this glorious day. And Broadcasting Magazine was talking about the dancing in the streets and how urgent it was that I'd be taken out of there immediately. This Quello appointment actually is probably worth a comment or two because I think it illustrates something about what's wrong. There was another name bandied about earlier, Glenn Robinson, a professor at the University of Minnesota, a fairly conservative fellow, but he was able to read and write, which put him in the upper ranks of Nixon appointees. And I felt that, after all, McGovern did not win, and one of the rights that goes with being president is the right to appoint people to office, and that therefore I should not oppose Mr. Robinson. I certainly shouldn't support him, because that would really be the death knell. So I said nothing at all. But he was passed over, and along came this mysterious fellow named Quello. Now, I'm going to tell you about Quello, and then I'm going to tell you where he came from, and then that's going to tell you a little something about something else that's going on right now. First, the setting, mind you. I mean, and let us view this, if we may, from the standpoint of just political savvy, all right? I mean, let's forget about the public interest. Everybody else has. And let's just address what would be the politically smart thing to do. Okay, now you've got a setting out of a political novel, a president who's on the threshold of impeachment, who's charged with having sold out the American government to the highest bidder, collecting $60 million from large American corporations in exchange for billions of dollars of governmental favors, paid for by taxpayers and consumers in higher taxes that they have to pay to make up for the taxes the rich aren't paying, and the higher prices they have to pay as consumers. Okay, that's the general scene. Specifically, with regard to regulatory commissions, after American Airlines violated the Corrupt Practices Act by giving a corporate donation to the president, they came around and asked to have their man put on the Civil Aeronautics Board. President Nixon promptly obliged and sent his name up. Senate Commerce Committee refused to hold hearings on him. And some 6 to 9 months later, still not held hearings on him. Following this experience, from which Nixon seemed to learn nothing, he next sent up a nominee of the natural gas industry to sit on the Federal Power Commission, a man named Morris. Now, bear in mind the nature of the debate that occurred at that time. No one contended that the Federal Power Commission ought to represent the public interest. The argument was about whether the votes in favor of higher natural gas prices and the benefits that flow to the natural gas industry, whether those votes should be 4-1 or 5-0. That was the issue. And President Nixon and the natural gas industry took the position that the votes should be 5-0. And the Senate Commerce Committee and Chairman Magnuson took the position that the vote should be 4-1. In any event, the Senate won that one. And for the first time in 40 years, a nominee of a president to a federal regulatory commission was turned down by the United States Senate. All right, that's the setting, right? And now the president has the question of who he is going to appoint to the Federal Communications Commission. And who does he come up with? But a lifetime broadcaster to put on the FCC to regulate the broadcasters. Now, Mr. Quello has other distinguishing features, none of which having to do with ability. He has come up predominantly through the sales side of the business, and so far as I know, has never expressed much in the way of thought about the social obligation of the institution known as broadcasting. Blacks within his own organization who were charged with enforcing the equal employment opportunity orders of the FCC, which the FCC was about 10 years late in putting into force but finally got around to, wrote memoranda within the corporation that evaluated Mr. Quello as the principal problem the company was confronting in complying with equal employment opportunity orders. It also turned out that to demonstrate his good Democratic credentials, since he's being appointed to a Democratic seat on the FCC, that Mr. Quello and his friends came up with $120,000 for Richard Nixon last year. All right, that's Mr. Quello. Now, where did Mr. Quello's name come from? And why was he selected for this position? Well, of course, I stopped breakfasting over at the White House every morning, as you may have guessed. But the story going around Washington is that Mr. Quello was sent up by the president because a close friend of the president's inveighed upon him to please do this, that the president owed him one favor, and would he please do this for him? And the president agreed. The name of that man should by today be somewhat more familiar to you than it might have been 2 weeks ago, none other than Gerry Ford. Well, some people think we've heard too much about Watergate in recent days, and you may be among them. They say, you know, after all, we've got the best administration money can buy. Actually, the networks fall into that category. I always think it's rather amusing that the networks are a little slow to pick up on these issues. You know, Dan Ellsberg first delivered his famous Pentagon Papers to the networks, and they refused to touch them until they'd first appeared in the New York Times, which is their principal, typical stance on new news items. And on the coverage of the Watergate hearings, they were very interested, so long as it involved bugging the Democratic National Committee and things of that sort. But as soon as it gets around to what is really the only important question, in a kind of fundamental sense in these hearings, namely, who gave the money and what did they get for it? It's not, as Senator Baker says, what did the president know and when did he know it? It's who gave the money and what did he get for it? Now, that's what the American people really need to find out, to understand how you buy and sell a government. It's a part of your political science course, and it ought to be taught, and there it can be on television. And now the networks decide suddenly that, no, they don't think it's deserving of as full a coverage, and even the committee seems to be somewhat reluctant to go into this subject with the same enthusiasm. Our country really does confront right now one of the greatest crises I think it's ever confronted, certainly since the time of the Civil War. The legitimate complaints of American citizens against President Richard in 1973 fully rival in every sense complaints of the American colonists against King George in 1776. Go back and reread the Declaration of Independence and that listing of grievances. And there's nothing there that is as bad, certainly not worse, than what we've been subjected to. That document is always good reading, provides that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these are, and read this slowly and often, life. Think about that, a government that devotes most of its resources to killing folks. Life, liberty, by a president who's authorizing break-ins, wiretapping, invasions of privacy and civil rights. Life and liberty, and yes, the pursuit of happiness. Can you imagine? The pursuit of happiness being associated in any way with what we've known as government in this country over the last few years? And that to secure these rights, that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. From the consent of the governed. Now, in my judgment, there's nothing wrong with that idea. It was good then, and it's good now. And if that makes me a conservative, so be it. I'll wear the label. But I believe in that stuff. I really do. And I think it'll still work. But during the past 5 years, the rights of the people of this country have been violated, and the control of their government has been taken from them. Today, more than ever, this country belongs to the mighty, to the wealthy, large corporate enterprises, conglomerate corporations, transnational corporations. These large corporations, which are bigger than most nations, there's a list of the largest countries and companies in the world, and it alternates as you go down the list. Two countries, one company, another country, two more companies. And it's that list that gives you a real perspective on who has the power, the real power in the world today. And nowhere is the growing power of the conglomerate corporations more evident than in agriculture, a matter of concern to those of us here in Iowa. We hear a lot of talk about rising food prices, and food prices have gone up, but this does not mean that the small family farmer is better off, and that's a very important point to clearly understand. 47% of the farm families in this country, 47%, one out of two roughly, have annual incomes below $3,000. More than 3 million family farms have folded since 1940, and they continue to close at the rate of 1,000 a week. For the first time since our nation was settled coast to coast about 100 years ago, farm population is now less than 10 million people. And along with the farms, the independent small town businesses are closing at a rate of more than 16,000 a year. At the present time, more than 73% of the American people live on less than 2% of the land. Well, now these are scarcely the signs of a great rural economic boom by my standards. And so you ask, where is the money going? And I'm about to tell you. For while the consumer's food dollar has been shrinking, the farmer's costs have been rising, 13 chain grocers increased their profits this year 134%. Comparable corporations have increased the farmer's costs by 122% since 1952, while the prices received by the farmer have gone up 6%. Many of them now in specialty crops, no longer having a varied farm family self-sustaining unit, have got to go into grocery stores the same way everybody else does. And when they do, they pay the same 43% increase in food prices as the rest of us. Now, part of the reason for this is also that of the 32,000 food manufacturing companies in this country, the 100 largest control 71% of all the food industry's profits. The Federal Trade Commission has estimated that with more competition in just 13 product lines, the impact on consumers would be a saving of at least $2 billion a year. The same thing is true across the board in American industry. There are about 40 American industries, major industries in this country, that are dominated by three or four firms. That's called an oligopoly. It's not a monopoly because there's more than just one firm. But the behavior of the firms with regard to price competition, technological innovation, etc., quality of service, is roughly the same as if there were a monopoly. And most major industries in America are now oligopolies. They are not a part of the free private enterprise system. And most of what American businessmen do when they come to Washington is not lobby on behalf of the free private enterprise system. They want subsidies. They want to have a chunk of a socialized sector of the economy. They want to have restraints on trade. They want to have exemptions from the antitrust laws. They want to have artificially fixed high prices. They want to be granted monopoly routes by the government. That's what they're doing in Washington. And the government officials, ironically enough, are the ones, like myself, who are saying, hey, fellas, how about some competition? You applauded the idea when the fella talked about it at Rotary. Why do you panic when it moves in next door? Huh? And so the estimates are, if we would truly enforce the antitrust laws, the savings to the American consumer across the board would be $100 billion a year. $100 billion a year. And you're paying your share of that because the U.S. government is not enforcing the antitrust laws and maintaining the free private enterprise economy that the businessmen talk about and lobby against. The point of all this is simply that our government is up for sale to the highest bidder. The excesses which have led to these payoffs and the mentality which has been willing to accept the bribes is also responsible for the more conventional abuses which are summed up in the one word Watergate, abuses which represent the most systematic, pervasive effort of political subversion this country has ever seen. But they pale by contrast to what it is we've been talking about. Now, I believe the strength of this country lies in its people. And I think that strength is probably represented here in the state of Iowa, or has been historically, as well as in any part of the United States. This is a state that is 25th out of the 50 states in area and in population. It's a state that has a blend of farming and industry and service trades in such a way that there is no single company that controls the state in the way that Delaware belongs to DuPont and so forth in many other states. And we can be quite thankful for that balance, even if it has so far been largely an accident. It's a state that has, or at least recently had, last time I looked, the highest literacy rate of any state in the United States. It has about the most colleges per 1,000 population of any state. It has, while not the best that one might hope for in terms of the broadcasting establishment, I think broadcasters that even I would concede are clearly a notch above the average that one confronts in other states of this country. We do have a blend out here of some of the cultural resources of the East, along with the small towns and the open fresh air and open spaces of the West. And I think politically, with the two senators we've got, we can be as proud of them as any state can be of its senatorial delegation. Now, I think in the months and years to come, as this country confronts the crisis that it's now before it, that Iowa has a great deal to offer the nation in terms of these basic values and purposes, values and purposes from which we have strayed, but values that tend to continue to thrive here. I think these strengths evolved naturally from the pioneer stock that came into this state that included my own grandfather in the 19th century going out to Western Iowa. Individuals who were seeking decent lives for themselves and for their children, to work the soil. But this is not automatic today. With the invidious influence of television advertising, with large conglomerate corporations and foreign interests buying up our land a section at a time, with chain stores in virtually every line of commerce sucking the money out of Iowa and into New York City. This is a time, I think, for Iowans above all, if we are to keep the model that we now show to the rest of the country, to think through what we really want for this state. These are times when, for example, Norway voted itself out of the common market. It said, we don't want more industrial development in Norway. The people of Colorado said, we don't want the Winter Olympics to come here. We know it's going to bring tourist dollars, but we don't want what else it's going to bring. The people of Oregon said, we don't want a tourism program. It's a time when people are beginning to question growth for growth's sake and beginning to get down to the fundamental issues of what they really want in their environment, in education, in hospitals, in transportation systems, in fresh air, in recreation facilities. And there is still time. Now, if we act quickly, those of you here in this room I'm talking about, and the professors in this school, and the others in the state, who will take some time in your courses and in your seminars and take a look at these questions. Come up with a transportation scheme for this region of the state. What do you want it to be in the year 2000? What will it cost to do it one way rather than another? What price do you pay in terms of the land that's taken out of cultivation? How do you want the suburban development to grow around Waterloo Cedar Falls? Do you like the idea of limiting the lots to 40 acres or whatever it was they proposed here recently? That's at least addressing the problem, whether or not that's the best solution. That represents somebody thinking ahead somewhere beyond next week's football game to imagine what is this part of the state going to look like. And you've got the resources. You've got smart professors and privileged students. And I didn't mean to say you weren't smart students. You're smart students, too. But you've got the opportunity. You've got the time. You've got the library resources. You've got the courses. And you can carve these problems out one at a time and really take a look at them and put together an approach that will enable the people of this region, the people of the state, to really confront these questions and decide what you do want the state to become. And in the course of doing that, presumably to involve yourselves, individual, in the political processes that go with that.
That was former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson speaking on the University of Northern Iowa's campus. That material came through the facilities of public radio station KHKE in Cedar Falls, Iowa. That concludes today's options. Funds for this program came through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For options, this is Robert Monteagle speaking, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.